Today is Monday, October 2nd. We're going to work on wrapping up bone information in the skeletal system chapter today. Okay, ossification is page 68. So technically the word ossification means bones growing. I mean, that's not really terribly scientific, is it? So what we're going to do is break it down and talk about different types of bone growth. And we're going to focus on one of these called endochondral ossification. That's how bones grow longer. We're not going to cover in any detail how bones of your face grow. Those are called flat bones, and they actually grow a little bit differently. They're going to grow at their edges like a pancake in the frying pan. Sometimes the edges sneak out of a pancake in the frying pan, and they may touch other pancakes. You know how that works? Okay, that's kind of how intramembranous ossification works. We're not going to cover that one. We're going to focus on growing bones longer. That's endochondral ossification. And we'll just touch on appositional growth. That's making bones grow wider. Okay, so our focus here is going to be making those bones grow longer. Before we move off this slide, let me emphasize something about the words you're looking at here. The word endochondral has some hidden clues. What is endo?
Within.
Good. And cond?
Cartilage.
Yeah, so use that as a helpful clue. There is cartilage inside bones, and that's going to lead to the lengthening of those bones. Is what happens from birth. You know, before babies are born, babies need a skeleton, and that skeleton is actually built from a type of cartilage. And that's what they're showing you here on the far left pictures. You'll see in this picture that the cartilage is really all that makes up a baby's or a fetus's skeleton. And around the outside, these are osteoblasts. What do you think those osteoblasts are there for? Yeah, to turn that into bone. So, you know, if you're thinking about a 40-week pregnancy, this is how the skeleton first initiates as a cartilage-like skeleton. And over the course of that pregnancy, the bones become more and more calcified. And that's the process those osteoblasts contribute. By the time a baby is born, the skeleton is on its way to being fully calcified. But, you know, we know that babies have rather flexible skeletons, and it takes most of your childhood years to really fully ossify those bones. What I'm going to show you is, in the middle of this picture right there, there's a piece of cartilage that's left behind. And this piece of cartilage is actually going to be the site where bone growth initiates. So you'll notice that osteoblasts join in that area. Now let's flip pictures. You'll see that this yellow region right through here is actually where that cartilage is found. Now keep in mind, we're dealing with a fetus skeleton. These bones may be nothing more than about an inch or so long. So we're dealing with itty bitty tiny bones that are not fully calcified yet. Notice we've also got a blood vessel. What is that blood vessel bringing into this bone? Yeah, nutrients, oxygen, and what do you really need to make those bones grow?
Calcium,
exactly. So if you watch right here through the middle, do you see how that looks like a marrow cavity starting to open up? It's bigger and even bigger. And what has happened is this region of cartilage is actually going to be split apart, and it's going to be pushed toward either end of your bone. And this piece of cartilage here starts out in the previous picture as what we call primary or first ossification center. And you can see when it splits apart and becomes separated, we now what's called a secondary ossification center. So the bone is going to start to pick up growth as we split those cartilages and we move toward opposite ends of that bone. So in this picture here, I'd like to break it down. Just take a look at it, see what we're looking at. Because from that point forward, in a child's growing bones, is what we experience. We experience a layer of hyaline cartilage serving as a growth plate, and then we have a layer of bone-forming cells called osteoblasts that push behind and make that bone grow longer. So I just want to kind of give you the history here as to what's going on behind all that. You know, when bones are growing in a fetus, there are bone destroying cells that actually eat out this opening here. What are they called?
Osteoclast,
and there's also a type of little teeny tiny organelle that helps to break down and recycle. That is a
lysosome.
Yeah. So those are helping to carve out this marrow cavity in here, becoming the home for that marrow. So yeah, let's pick one of these ends of the bone that are identical and just work on what happens there during bone growth. So let's do this. Let's get rid of that screen for just a moment. You guys a little bit of room at the bottom of your page. You know, you're welcome to jot this down. You can snap a picture when we're done if you'd like as well. So we're looking at how bones lengthen in a child. This is going to start before the child is born, and this is going to occur up until around age 18 to 21. By the time you're reaching, say, age 18 or so, your bone growth is going to start to slow down. By the time you're age 21, you're no longer going to experience any upward growth. You're not going to be getting taller after that age. And of course, you know, by the time you're 25, you're looking at fully ossified or calcified bones. What does that mean has happened to the cartilage in your bones by age 25?
They're hard as they can be.
Yep. So there's no more cartilage there, no more bone growth in a 25-year-old. So what I'd like to do is draw a region that we're going to call our epiphyseal plate. What type of tissue makes up your epiphyseal plate?
Hyaline cartilage.
Good. Let's put a layer of hyaline cartilage down. Cartilage layer, a growth plate. And right behind it, I'm going to put a layer of osteoblast. Osteoblasts doing for a living? Making the bones grow, right? And they do this by depositing
calcium.
Yeah. So they're depositing calcium into this bone, and the only place they can deposit that calcium is where you find the epiphyseal plate. So the plate is going to be dividing, but you know the story about cartilage, right? How quickly can cartilage divide? Very slow, yes. So we're looking at a really slow growth rate. Growth rate in that hyaline cartilage. And those osteoblasts are going to be dividing and replacing that cartilage with new calcified bone. So over time, I'm going to put some bone in here. We're going to start making that area turn into bone. And in order to stay ahead of the game, to make sure that we don't essentially run over our epiphyseal plate, I'm going to have to put a new layer of hyaline cartilage up here. And every time I push my osteoblast a step forward, what do I have to do to my hyaline cartilage to keep growing? Move it up, bump it up. And every time I bump up my hyaline cartilage a layer, what happens to the length of our bone?
It stretches.
Yep, stretches longer. So we'll just make our bone a little bit bigger here. Okay, and over time, you're going to keep making your bone grow longer and longer. And so this is going to take place from the time that you're basically a fetus up until your middle teenage years. By the time you reach around, say, 14 or 15, most people are full of sex hormones. So puberty has hit, right? Okay, and so puberty says to these growth plates, divide faster, and also those osteoblasts will replace that cartilage with bone even more faster. So you know how steamrollers that pave roads work, right? They toss all those rocks out on the road, and then here comes the steamroller, and the steamroller steamrolls those rocks into a new road. That's what's going to happen. Who's your steamroller here?
Osteoblasts.
Osteoblasts. And around the time puberty hits, what are they going to do to your hyaline cartilage plate?
Keep
pushing it. Yeah. And you know what? That hyaline cartilage says, oh, but I'm really slow. I can only divide so fast. And those osteoblasts say, we're the steamroller, so you either march or get out of the way. They get run over. So by the time you're around age 18, guess what those osteoblasts have done to that plate? They pushed it as far as it's going to go, and we're just going to make all of this area in here, not cartilage, but bone. Yeah. So goodbye to that cartilage. That is all turned into bone. Hormones like estrogen for females, testosterone for males is going to make that epiphyseal plate and the growth of those osteoblasts kind of speed up, but this is the last hurrah. This is your last chance for bone growth. Secondary ossification center, and it's that layer of osteoblast down below. But if you consider that the bone probably started when it was that long, it got pushed toward either end. And let me put this back down and we'll take a look at it. So when the bone is really, really tiny, that cartilage is dividing in the middle. And then as the bone starts to grow, you'll actually get a bunch of blood vessels invading that space, and it separates your bone growth into two separate pieces at either end. So that marrow cavity kind of comes in and it says, hey, hyaline cartilage, go that way, and it starts pushing it toward opposite ends. And then now you've got growth plates down here separated by the marrow cavity in the middle. So technically, once you've separated those ossification centers, then yeah, you've got growth occurring at either end. Yeah, but initially, like when we're a fetus, that's where it began, was at the very center. Yeah. So pretty cool what happens. What you end up starting with is like this picture here. You've got a region of hyaline cartilage in there. By the time you're, say, into your early 20s, that cartilage is done. It has been turned into calcified bone. And we no longer call it a plate. What should we call it instead? Yeah, call it a line. So it actually is just a little remnant of, hey, this is where bone growth once occurred. And in this picture, what we're looking at, again, is the end of the bone. And this stuff in here is all cartilage that's undergoing cell division. And down below, this stuff is actually bone tissue that's forming. And so I think of it as a slow motion chase. This chase takes from, say, birth until you're like 15 years old. The osteoblasts are chasing the cartilage cells, and once puberty hits, we run over those cartilage cells and we start to calcify them, that ends the possibility of lengthening your bones. Okay? So going back to the original term here, we call this endochondral ossification. What is the cartilage that we're talking about inside our bones? Hyaline cartilage. And what does it form? It does form bone, yes. So ultimately, it's going to be forming bone when it's replaced by calcium, thanks to what kind of bone-forming cell?
Osteoblast.
Osteoblast, yeah. Okay. So another good picture here. You've got a good layer of cartilage through the middle here. This is, you know, at the end of each bone. And then there is a zone of ossification. What types of cells do you expect to see at that zone? Blast, yeah. And so, like we were talking, it's a slow motion chase, and eventually that layer of osteoblast runs over and calcifies all that hyaline cartilage. Okay. Bottom of your page, I do want to point out something called appositional growth. And appositional growth is what can occur at any time of your life. Let me put it to you this way. If you've ever watched a tree in your yard grow, you may have realized that the tree not only grows taller, but that tree trunk also gets wider. And that tree trunk can get wider when it's a sapling, when it's a 5-year-old tree, when it's a 25-year-old tree, and even when it gets to be a 50-year-old tree, it can still grow wider, right? Okay? That's how we work. We only grow taller until our late teens, early 20s. But at any point in your lifetime, your bones can grow wider. And so we call this appositional growth, and this growth occurs from the periosteum all along the diaphysis there. So what are some things that you can do to promote appositional growth?
Exercise.
Exercise, good, good. How about diet? What could you have more of? Calcium, vitamin D, yeah. So exercise puts stress on these bones. When your bones are stressed, they'll become wider through appositional growth. And you can also increase your calcium intake and vitamin D intake. Those two can help make your bones grow stronger and wider. So if you're thinking about like an 80-year-old person, you think, gosh, you don't necessarily want to encourage them to lift weights, or would you?
If they're light, if they're not overbearing.
Yeah, don't give them 100-pound weight and say, here you go, right? Yeah, start them off slow, right? Okay, so if you're going to start, say, an 80-year-old patient out with lightweight weights to lift, what is the benefit for them?
Help build bone.
Help build bone, yeah. So for those who may be at a risk for fractures, building bone through weightlifting may be a way to actually avoid fractures instead of causing them. So kind of a cool concept there. The more you stress your bones, the stronger and healthier they can become. Okay, Doc, so that should take you down there to the bottom of page 68. Anything I can clarify for you there? All right, let's talk about hormones. Hormones pretty much during the first 2 weeks of Bio 211. If you can hang on to this stuff through Bio 211, it'll be really helpful to you. So our first blank at the top of the page is for a term called parathyroid hormone, PTH for short. Since you're copying down stuff, that number two blank is calcitonin. And then I believe you guys have a bullet point, number three. Yeah, number three is next. That is growth hormone. That number three blank is growth hormone. Thank you. one still need this slide? All right, so the first hormone is called parathyroid hormone. It is made by a set of glands in your neck called parathyroid glands. Hey, that's pretty easy to remember, right? So you've got a thyroid gland that's shaped kind of like a butterfly that wraps around your trachea. If you feel for your Adam's apple, which is a piece of cartilage, right beneath it, you're going to find a little butterfly-shaped gland. That's the thyroid gland. If you were actually able to take it off or remove it and look on the back side, you would find 4 to 8 nodules of parathyroid gland tissue. And so that's what they're pointing at here, are those little pieces. So it kind of makes it look like a polka dot bow tie, okay? So the parathyroid glands make one hormone, and that one's called parathyroid hormone. The job of parathyroid hormone is to regulate blood what? Calcium. Yep, regulate blood calcium levels. It does this by increasing your blood calcium. So what kind of bone-destroying cells are activated?
Osteoclasts,
good. So let me give you some examples when parathyroid hormone may be active. If you're talking about a mom who is breastfeeding her baby, breast milk needs calcium for the baby's skeleton to grow. So, where does mom get the calcium from?
From her bones,
exactly. So, her body breaks down the bones, even her teeth, puts the calcium into the breast milk and gives the calcium to the babies. They say that women who breastfeed lose on average 2 to 3% of their body skeleton, which is replaced once you stop breastfeeding. There is an old saying that goes, for every child, a tooth is lost. And you can imagine back in the day, you know, where maybe moms weren't getting enough nutrition, that if mom was breastfeeding, I can talk, it's really a Monday, isn't it? Breastfeeding a baby, that she might have had cavities, loose teeth that fell out, all thanks to the activity of those osteoclasts. Yeah, so pretty sad thing there. All right, so there's a hormone that works as an antagonist to PTH. What does it mean to be an antagonist?
It's against.
So the antagonist is called calcitonin. Calcitonin is actually made by the thyroid gland, the one that's shaped like a bow tie or butterfly. And it is going to lower your blood calcium levels. In this case, what type of bone-forming cells are activated by calcitonin?
Osteoblasts.
Good. All right, so which of these hormones do you think is most active in a child?
Calcitonin.
Yeah, calcitonin, yeah. So kids that are growing that needs calcium added to their bones, calcitonin's doing that job. They actually think that once you reach adulthood, that PTH is the more active regulator of blood calcium levels. So it seems to be that calcitonin is the more active in the childhood growing years. Let's see, number 3 is growth hormone. I like biology that tells it like it is. Guess what growth hormone makes you do?
Grow.
Okay, that's easy enough to remember.
Surprise of biology.
This hormone comes from a gland in your brain. It's called the pituitary gland. And this particular gland releases a whole bunch of hormones we'll talk about in Bio 211, but like the name implies, growth hormone tells your body cells to grow. So, you know, that could be skin cells, that could be liver cells, that could be your bones and your muscles. We tend to see the most growth occurring during what time of your life?
When you're a child,
yeah, during your childhood years. We do not expect to see lengthening of bones occur after around age what?
25.
Yeah, absolutely none after 25. By age 18 to 21, you're probably starting to be done, right? So 18 to 21, your upward growth is going to start to come to a halt. This upward growth promoted by growth hormone is called what? Ossification. Is it called appositional ossification or endochondral?
Endochondral.
Endochondral, yeah. So that's a big effect that we do see from growth hormone. I'd like to share with you some disorders associated with growth hormone. This one is called gigantism. On the far left, you'll notice a man that has an extreme size. They technically look at giants as being people in the upper 6 foot, 7 foot range, 8 foot, 9 foot range. There have been stories throughout history of people that have been somewhere between 12 and 14 feet. But our most recent tallest man has capped out pushing around 9 feet tall. So that's pretty tall for the past 100 years or so. So. What's that?
I said his bones are probably working overtime.
Oh, seriously, overtime, yeah. This guy here, he is our tallest giant in recorded history, and that's, I'm talking last 100, 150 years. So, you know, obviously there have been taller people than that throughout the thousands of years people have lived. So we're looking at 8 foot 11 inches here, almost between 400 and 500 pounds. He was not done growing, even though he was age 22 when he passed away. Why is that unusual, age 22 and still growing? Yeah, after 21, he really should have seen a big slowdown, and by age 25, he should have been done with bone growth. So guess what he had not experienced yet?
Puberty.
Puberty.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
He had not gone through puberty.
Talk about out of childhood.
Yeah. So he was touring with the circus back in the 1940s. He had to wear custom leg braces. He is not, you know, or any of these giants are not tall, strong, capable people. They are crippled. They have bones and joints that cannot handle their body's weight. Their rib cage and their heart and lungs are not necessarily built to accommodate for the huge body size. So he got a blister on his foot from the leg braces. We've all heard, don't pop the blister. 2 weeks later, his blister had caused a body-wide infection, and he was dead. And unfortunately, this was right before the time of antibiotics. Nowadays, we probably could have not only slowed his upward growth with testosterone, but we could have also treated the blister that he died from. Down at Myrtle Beach, the Ripley's, believe it or not, actually has a wax figure of this guy out by the street. You don't have to pay to see it. You can just stand and look through the glass and see him inside. Pretty impressive, tall, almost 9 foot tall figurine of him. When he passed away, they buried him in a concrete vault in Illinois. They were afraid people would dig him up, parade him around, so they basically ensured that that would not happen. Yeah. You know, 8 foot is actually pushing pretty much the limits of what we've seen. So this guy here, you can see he's got a cane. In his late 30s, is actually the tallest man currently alive at 8'3". You see that guy's face? Gigantism, but you know, he retired from debilitating joint issues. He was not able to play for very long. And again, this is just an issue of having joints that are not able to handle the body's weight and size. This lady here she was in her 40s when she passed away. A lot of these people are not able to, you know, get around. They become very crippled by their body size. Their body can't handle pumping blood to a 7 or 8 foot tall, you know, human when the heart is built to pump maybe for a 5 foot tall person. It burns the heart out. Yeah, it just wears it out. So, you know, if you pass through puberty in your mid-teenage years, then that's going to help hasten the closure of your epiphyseal plates. But what if you still have large amounts of growth hormone coursing through your body at age 30, 40, 50? What's going to happen to your features if you can't grow taller? They grow wider. And we call this type of growth appositional growth, yeah. So in the case of appositional growth, we often look at the pituitary gland as being the problem, and we see enlargements of the extremities. That is what acromegaly means. It means enlargement of the extremities. So we are looking at an enlarged brow ridge, nasal bone, jawbone in this guy. It also gives you enlarged hands and feet. Doesn't even look like the same person, does it? So at what age do you think you might start noticing the effects of acromegaly?
Like
after 25. Exactly. Why would you not notice it before 25?
Because your body's supposed to grow very fast.
Yeah, you're still growing up, so you wouldn't be able to tell that your bones are getting wider. Why do you not notice acromegaly on your femur? Why do you not notice acromegaly on your humerus? Yeah, would you really know if your femur got bigger?
No.
No. Would you notice if your finger bones got bigger?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot less tissue there than there is around your femur and your humerus. You may have heard of Andre the Giant. He was a wrestler and an actor back in the 70s and 80s. He passed away from heart condition, not a surprise there. He had both gigantism and he had acromegaly. Let's see, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we now have a condition that we're looking at called pituitary dwarfism. And we're looking specifically at these two people right here. They look like children mixed in with a bunch of other types of dwarfs. The specific issue with pituitary dwarfism is a lack of growth hormone. When is it going to primarily affect you?
Probably during childhood.
Childhood, yeah. So as kids, these two people here probably didn't have enough growth hormone, and so their bodies didn't grow tall enough. Once their epiphyseal plates closed, game over, right? Okay. So these people here, this one and the other two, are actually a different type of dwarf. In fact, there's over 100 different kinds of dwarfism. These two have something called achondroplasia. That is the kind of dwarfism on Little People, Big World. Their growth plates simply don't respond to growth hormone. This person has something called cretinism or congenital hypothyroidism. That particular condition is a lack of thyroid hormone. Totally different issue. So nowadays, if they suspect a person is having, say, pituitary dwarfism, this is what they can do. So they can x-ray your hand, and if they get growth plates still visible, good news, right? Okay. But if they don't see growth plates, like in the picture on the right, they know that your plates have turned into lines. Yeah. And are you capable now of having lengthwise growth? It's impossible, right? So if you ignored this and you still gave this person with the epiphyseal lines some growth hormone, instead of making them taller, you'd make their bones grow
wider.
And that's called acromegaly. Yeah, and that's appositional growth, exactly. How about questions so far? All right, about halfway down your page, we've got calcitriol. And so calcitriol is actually a vitamin D3 form. So how do you make vitamin D?
Sunlight.
Yeah, make vitamin. Yep, and drinking milk, good. So calcitriol is important for helping to regulate your body's calcium and phosphorus metabolism. Where do we store the majority of our calcium and our phosphorus? Bones, yep. Got to store it in the bones. Okay, got you a couple of disorders there for calcitriol or vitamin D3. One of them is a disorder called osteomalacia. If you break the word down, it's very helpful because we know osteo is bone, right? What about mal or malacia?
Softening.
Softening, yeah. So technically, this is a softening condition for the bones. It is a problem that affects primarily adults, not kids. The bones may be soft and they may fracture under your body's weight. I think that'll give you all three bullet point answers, won't it? Okay, so that first question there, what is the cause of osteomalacia? Vitamin D deficiency. The second question, what age group is affected?
Older people.
Older people, yeah. Oh, and the actual second question that I skipped over, how are bones affected? Yeah, if there's not enough calcium, bones are soft, and they easily fracture. You may know an older person who has lost 3-5 inches off their overall height. And if it's actually a vitamin D issue, it could be osteomalacia. It could also be a osteoporosis issue, which is related but actually a different underlying cause. The word porosis means pore-like, right? So in that case, the bone actually may become more porous. Still the same results. They still may lose inches off their height. But the real issue here with this one is actually a calcium. We're not depositing enough calcium to the bones, so they become soft and can fracture.
So for what age group is affected? Adults.
Adults, yeah. Let's run through the questions for rickets. The cause of rickets is a vitamin D deficiency. This feels like a rerun. Bones are going to be soft and will fracture. But this time, what age group is affected?
Children.
Yeah, children, good. Now, if this affects you during your childhood or growing years, it may impact your overall height. So people who have rickets may not grow more than around 4, maybe 5 feet in height. And you can see that the bones are bowed under the body's weight. We would not expect necessarily to see bowed legs in an older person because their bones already grew straight earlier in life. But if this is the problem from the get-go, you know, from childhood up, then yeah, we may see bowed bones like you see in these pictures. I don't mean to imply that anybody with bowed legs is probably a rickets candidate. Those two things may be completely exclusive of each other, but it is something that we see when you've got soft bones that cannot support the body's weight. Yeah, and that's exactly what they do. They do fracture when they're trying to be supportive. Yep. No, not quite like that. Let's hit thyroid hormone next. Thyroid hormone is something we'll also discover more about in Bio-211. It is our metabolic hormone, and it controls our metabolic rate. We're going to talk specifically about the major hormone of the two. It's called thyroxine. It's listed there on your paper. And it actually increases osteoblast activity and decreases osteoclast activity. If that's what you're doing to your bones, are you mostly building them up or breaking them down? You're mostly building them up, yeah. So if you're favoring osteoblast activity, you're mostly building up your bones. Just kind of as a side note here, if you don't have enough thyroid hormone as a kid, then you can grow up with a condition that causes, once again, dwarfism. This is called cretinism, otherwise known as congenital hypothyroidism. And the unfortunate other side effect of having too little thyroxine as a child, it can also cause problems with development with your central nervous system. So we may see things like mental retardation that can result simply from not having enough thyroxine. Nowadays, they test at birth for this. Poor babies get poked and prodded the day they're born. They've gone through enough trauma, but we still poke and prod them. We test their blood for thyroid levels, and if they need treatment, then we start early on because we want to avoid having this very treatable condition before that baby gets old enough to suffer brain damage.
But they catch it early.
Yep, they catch it early. Because these people, this one here on the far left, you know, he may be an adult, and it may not be treatable. You know, he certainly may not be able to grow taller, and they may not be able to treat anything else for him. All right, let's see. We've got sex hormones as well. Do sex hormones stop bone growth, or do they encourage one last hurrah of bone growth?
Encourage,
yeah. So we're going to see one big last poof of bone growth. You may grow 4 to 6 inches in a year, thank you to sex hormones. And then eventually, that ossification line of osteoclast will do what to your plate? Run it over.
Yeah.
Run it over. So those osteoblasts are so excited to be growing at such a fast rate, they may eventually just run the heck over your epiphyseal plate, and that'll be the end of that bone growth. Okay, just a couple of things to appreciate at the bottom of your page. Let's talk about exercise first. And it says here, for exercise, how do bones respond to stress?
They strengthen.
Yeah, add more calcium to strengthen the bone. Good. Add more calcium to strengthen that bone. Add more calcium to strengthen that bone. Kind of the same question, why is exercise necessary? Yeah, to keep bones strong and healthy, that's good. Exercise keeps bones strong and healthy. And then finally, what happens to bones that are not stressed? Yeah, they'll lose bone mass, like you can see in this picture. They shrink. They sure do. Okay, so bones that are not exercised or bones that are not stressed will shrink. They lose mass. And guess what they're more susceptible to? Yeah, osteoporosis, they're more susceptible to fractures and breaks. And then speaking of osteoporosis, the very last thing down there on the bottom of your page mentions this one. The cause of osteoporosis is brittle and thin bones. Technically, the word means porous bones. This is often related to things like loss of estrogen as women get past their menopausal years. Women seem to be more affected than men. And in fact, certain ethnic groups seem to be more affected than others. Okay, so women more than men. So, wow, I mean, you can see inches of height being lost through osteoporosis.
So what's
the cause? The cause is brittle bones. It's a thinning, yeah, thinning of the bone mass. How about questions so far? Alright, so just a little bit left for us on bone fractures and bone healing. That's going to come from page 71. Alright, so at the very top of your page, let's just clarify the difference between an open fracture versus a closed fracture. Open fractures are ones that poke through the skin. Closed fractures do not. Which type of fracture leaves you at a greater risk of bone infection?
Open.
Open, yeah. And that bone infection is called osteomyelitis. You can see in this picture there's places where the arrows are pointing is actually an infected bone, and that may have been from the fact that it poked through the skin surface and got, you know, some bacteria.
If they're under oxygen, that the outside air is toxic to your bones, whenever they go out like that?
I'm not sure that the oxygen would be toxic, but you're picking up bacteria that are normally on the skin surface that are prevented from getting inside, and now you've got them basically swiping past bone marrow. That's probably the bigger issue. Osteomyelitis can actually cause something called compartment syndrome. Ever heard of compartment syndrome? If you have inflammation, what are the four cardinal signs? There you go. Okay, now focus on that swelling issue. If you break a bone, it's going to experience inflammation, and the surrounding tissue may also experience inflammation. We've talked about loose areolar connective tissue, right? Okay, what was the function of loose areolar? It's a wrapper, it's a packager. Okay, and you may notice these pieces of muscle tissue are wrapped and packaged, in fact, by loose areolar connective tissue. If you break the bone and the surrounding area becomes inflamed, it's packaged by loose areolar connective tissue. So this area may become very swollen, it may seep fluids, and in some cases they actually have to cut you open and just let the fluid drain because the pressure is so great from that compartment syndrome. It will, it'll burst the skin apart, it'll eventually rupture you, yeah. So if you happen to have a broken bone, you can have it repaired either by close reduction, that means manually setting the bones, or through open reduction, which is using surgical pins placed in there. But whichever way we go, we're going to have to go through about a 4 to 6 week healing process in order to repair that bone tissue. So, got a question? Absolutely, plenty of pain, plenty of bleeding, yeah. Okay, so the very first step to take place in any time you have a broken bone is called a hematoma. In plain English, what is that? A bruise, yeah. It's a blood clot, it's a bruise. And so that bruise is going to start the healing process for this bone. Back when we talked about how to make a bone grow, we didn't actually start with calcified bone. Instead, what did we start with? Hyaline cartilage, yeah. That's what you do next. It's not necessarily hyaline that comes in, it's a neighbor, it's fibrocartilage. But nonetheless, you see that we're going to bring in something to kind of stabilize that bone. So fibrocartilage is going to be the initial thing that comes in to stabilize and allow us to start growing that bone back. Now that you have kind of a stabilizer in place, we now see a bony callus form, and this is when you bring an osteoblast to deposit calcium, and you may also involve osteoclast. And then finally, once you've got the bone knitted back together, we do need to remodel that bone. What type of bone-destroying cell will remove excess bone tissue?
Osteoclast.
Yeah, osteoclast will remove that extra tissue. So for a young, healthy bone, we're looking at like 4 to 6 weeks of heal time. Interesting to note, if you break cartilage, is it longer or shorter than that time period?
Longer.
It's longer, yeah. So if you had the choice, like you can choose, right? But if you had the choice, break the bone, it heals much better than cartilage. Cartilage is mostly avascular, so it does not like to heal. Down near the bottom of your page, I'd just like to introduce a couple of common fractures. The first one is called a green stick fracture, and it is exactly as it implies. If you go running through your yard and twist the limb of a brand new bush that has green sticks, you're not going to be able to break the sticks off, right? All those branches do is just twist with your hand. And that's what happens to young growing bones, because they're still flexible with a good deal of cartilage. Instead of making a clean break, what we see is an incomplete break called a green stick fracture. You'll want to highlight that this is common in kids. Why is that? Bones are still growing, exactly. Their bones have not finished becoming calcified yet. Bones are still growing. This is a compression fracture. Did Did everybody get to sign in? So a few minutes ago, we were talking about bone disorders. What type of porous bone condition may result in a compressed fracture? Osteoporosis, right. And unfortunately, this can crush your vertebrae, your discs in between. It can pinch your spinal nerves and give you pain. So unfortunately, this problem comes with age and having a more porous skeleton. This looks painful. This is a depressed fracture, and it's common with sports injuries. Imagine a ball hitting someone's head causing this depressed fracture. Yeah, and nowadays we'd have to take that bone off probably to keep you from having brain problems. Yeah. It sure does. It has the inflammation like every other part. You're right. Okay. And then we've got spiral fractures, which are common in sports injuries. You know, if someone's running and twisting, then the bone actually takes on a spiral-shaped break. And then finally, this one is a multiple break fracture, comminuted fractures. So it's not just one clean break. You've got multiple broken bones here that need to be put back together. So in the last few minutes, I thought I'd take you as far as I can with articulations. Hopefully that'll help you guys for Wednesday's lab test. All right, do you have any questions before we head into articulations? Do you have any questions? Okay, let me just mention this particular chapter is not on test two. This particular chapter is test three material.
I have a question.
Sure.
Although practice exams do well, it does have one question to go.
I used to cover this on test two.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you see an old test that has articulations, just put them aside for test three.
Okay.
Okay, so let's break down joints. Joints are known as articulations, and we can classify them as functional or as structural. Okay, so let's talk about functional joints first. Functional joints are ones that are classified based on their mobility. In other words, how movable is a functional joint? If it's not movable, we say it's a synarthrosis. If it's somewhat movable, amphiarthrosis, and freely movable, it is diarthrosis. If you remember that these functional joints are sad, that will help you keep them straight from least movable to most movable. Functional joints are sad. And I can't emphasize enough to use your vocab here. Syn is together or with. What is amphi? On both sides? Between, yet. And we're looking at cartilage, basically, between bone. And how about a di? Diarthrosis.
Two.
Yep. So arthrosis means joint. So we're just going to use those prefixes to kind of drive our understanding. Now, in terms of structural categories, we've got fibrous, cartilaginous, and synovial. Let me caution you about drawing a direct correlation across. Synarthrosis may be fibrous, but they may also be cartilaginous. Amphiarthroses can be cartilaginous, but they can also be fibrous. Okay? And then the only one that you can go directly across with is a diarthrosis. It is synovial. Yeah, so that one you can draw a straight line and say link them up. Okay. You know, when we test on this stuff for test number three, probably what I would recommend doing is just putting it on flashcards and just keep working it until you can get this stuff to stick, or just keep testing yourself with questions on old quizzes, old tests. Some of these words are just monstrous. It's just getting them straight, right? So first of all, synarthroses. Are we working on a functional category right now or a structural category?
Functional.
Yeah, all the sad ones have an arthrosis ending. Okay. So we can classify our synarthroses as fibrous, meaning they're grown together with collagen fibers, or we're looking at cartilage between those two bones. Either way, these are not movable joints. So these are skull sutures, not meant to move, right? Okay, that'd be really painful if your skull sutures were migrating and moving. They are not meant to move. They form from fontanelles, which are soft spots present early on in your life. Okay, and they give your brain room to grow during the first few years of life, and then they fuse into these basically bone knitted into bone structures that we call sutures. Another kind of immovable joint is your teeth, although we try really hard to make our teeth move. We wear braces, we wear retainers, all sorts of things can make our teeth move. But you may notice it takes months and years to get them to get to their final destination. So the gomphosis joint is technically a gum, that's my way of remembering it, right? It's a gum and tooth kind of joiner between the tooth and the mandible or maxilla. Here's a fun thing to think about. If you're wearing braces, are you waiting for your osteoclast to move your teeth or your osteoblast?
Clast.
Clast, yeah. And then when you get them situated into their new destination, now you want to blast. Hold them in place with blast.
What's the point of having your molars in the back of your teeth? Everybody usually has to have it took out. What's the point of the molars in the back of your mouth?
They're for grinding, and you know, some of us don't have a mouth big enough for that fourth and final set, those wisdom, or the third final set, those wisdom teeth, but they're meant to be there for grinding. So apparently over time, our mandible and maxilla has evolved to not have room for that final set. We're still in a functional category called the synarthrosis category. We are looking at a cartilaginous example, and this is the epiphyseal plate. Could you imagine how painful it would be if you were running and you not only bent at the knees, but you were bending at the epiphyseal plate in your femur and your tibia? Ooh, ow. Yeah. Yeah, no more bone growth if that's the case, right? So these joints are not meant to be movable, but we consider them joints because they're two bones being held together by this layer of hyaline cartilage. So it's kind of interesting that we consider your epiphyseal plate a joint. Not a movable one, but nonetheless a joint. Okay. Let's talk about amphiarthroses. These are somewhat flexible joints. They can be cartilaginous, they can be fibrous. So let's talk about the symphysis joint. This piece of cartilage right between your two pubic bones is known as your pubic symphysis. And who do you think this is more movable for?
Women.
Yeah. During what time period?
Childbirth,
yeah. There's actually a hormone called relaxin that tells this joint to relax. And sometime during pregnancy, women start getting that pregnant waddle. And they do that waddle until their baby is born. And that's because their pelvic bones are all kind of slipping apart. So the whole reason here is to get more room in the pelvic outlet, this space in here, for the baby's head to fit through. After birth, relaxin is no longer made, and hopefully her pelvis goes back to the way it once was. Yeah. Another symphysis joint is the intervertebral discs in our back. Those, of course, are made up of a type of cartilage, fibrocartilage, that is great for being a cushioning device. And we have some degree of flexibility in our backs. So let's review. What is the functional classification of the intervertebral discs?
Amphiarthrosis, good. And the structural classification? Cartilaginous, good. Good. That's the way you want to practice these for your lab test Wednesday. Another structural amphiarthrosis joint is a fibrous joint found between your bones of your lower arm and lower leg. Your ulna and radius, tibia and fibula are held together by these ligaments that prevent too much mobility. So in these cases of ligaments holding bone to bone, we think of this as being a fibrous type of amphiarthrosis joint. So this is something to really appreciate, something to sink your teeth into. What type of tissue makes up a ligament? Dense regular, good. Is that a type of epithelial, connective, muscle? It's connective. What is the predominant fiber type in dense regular?
Collagen.
Good. Fiber, collagen, fibrous, right? Okay. So is a ligament a slightly movable structure or a immovable structure?
Slightly movable,
right? So you get a little degree of flexibility between your ulna and radius and between tibia and fibula. The final category is the easy one to remember, and I believe you're going to have to flip on over with me. These diarthroses are classified structurally as synovial joints. Thinking back to what we discussed about a week or so ago, can you tell me about a synovial membrane? They line these movable joints. They secrete a fluid called? Good. And what is the function of that synovial fluid?
Lubricate,
reduce friction in those joints. Can you give me some examples of synovial joints in your arm?
Elbow,
good.
Shoulder.
Wrist. Even fingers. Yeah. So we've got a lot of freely movable joints lined with synovial membranes secreting synovial fluid. And these are our freely movable joints. So let's talk about the parts of your typical synovial joint for just a moment. We have articular cartilage. In many cases, it's hyaline. And the function of this cartilage is to reduce friction in the joint. We've also got fluid in these joints. What is the function of that fluid?
Lubricate,
reduce friction. Many of our joints have fat pads. Like behind your knee, you've got a pocket of fat. That's also a cushioning device back there. We also have these bursa sacs that are scattered around the joint that also act as cushioning like water balloons. Those bursa sacs can become inflamed and, of course, cause bursitis. Okay? And then we have tendons and ligaments. So back to those same old two. Tell me what a ligament connects a bone to.
Bone.
Yep. Ligaments connect bone to bone. And tendons anchor muscles to bone. Yep. Ligaments connect bone to bone. Keep in mind that Larry buys books, LBB. And tendons bind muscle to bone. Both are made of what type of tissue?
Dense regular.
Good, that's right. Looks like we'll probably save 74 and the pictures on 75 for class on Wednesday. I'll probably do a little bit of muscles with y'all on Wednesday to see how things go. Do bring your questions. We'll spend as much time as you like doing Q&A for test number 3.